Welcome, everybody. Today, we're pleased to have Michele Mosca coming from wherever he is right now, presumably in Waterloo. So Mike was actually, in some sense, the very first scientist at PI, because he, after getting his PhD at Oxford, he got a faculty position at University of Waterloo in the Combinatorics and Optimization Department, and then was one of the founding members of PI. He was an associate faculty at PI when PI started, and has continued to be a member of PI since then. He's won a number of awards and honors. Looking at the most recent one, I see he's a knight in the Order of Merit of the Italian Republic, founder of a couple of startup companies in Waterloo region, and various other kinds of initiatives. And today he's going to be telling us about quantum safe future cryptography.
Thanks a lot, Daniel. Well, thanks for joining, everyone. I hope you're all doing well, wherever you may be. So it's a pleasure to have a chance to give a colloquium on this topic. As we're, you know, experiencing today, you know, readiness is too often an afterthought, and you know, insecurity and readiness as well. And you know, there's a nice article almost 5 years ago from the former director of the CIA and NSA, not at the same time, but he held both those roles. You know, basically chastising ourselves, or well, the US themselves for this. At the time, this was after, you know, China apparently had hacked the Office of Personnel Management. And he said that was shame on us. And the broad underlying problem he was pointing to was, you know, we love the ease and convenience of putting everything in digital form and online and so on, and without even really understanding the vulnerabilities. And he warned that it's not going to be as like it was in sort of physical world. Now, if you want, how do you even achieve security in so-called cyberspace? On the one hand, it just seems fundamentally impossible. You're giving your information, you're trusting your information to untrusted systems. So how could that possibly work? Well, cryptography is sort of the magic that makes that work. And you know, of course, crypto on its own isn't enough. There's always some element of trust, some element of physical security. And of course, without crypto, you can still communicate securely and so on, but the information always has to be packaged in a physically secure box of some sort, always in trusted, the hands of trusted people and trusted locations that are physically secured. So you can do that, but obviously that doesn't allow you to leverage something like the internet or any sort of not completely trusted agents or systems. So crypto, it doesn't eliminate your need for some trusted entities or some physical security, but it drastically reduces what and how much you need to trust. And the cryptography link in that so-called chain, and those are the Borromean rings depicted there. So if you cut one link, the other two, everything kind of falls apart. The cryptography link, in a sense, needs to be the strongest link, because unlike breaking a trust assumption, right, if somebody decides to compromise you, that's a very real-time thing. It's a very ephemeral risk. You can't, with crypto, especially with ciphertext, you can record it now, store it, and exploit it at a future date where you have the capability or desire to exploit it. So it's an interdependent system of assumptions, but cryptography, in a sense, well, first of all, is a vastly enabling assumption or a vastly enabling new ingredient that needs to be very strong. And just to sort of summarize three of the most common cryptographic tools we use essentially every single day, and I'll give a bit of a toy example, one you might not be using every day, but there's ones you do use every day that use the same methods. If Bob wants to send a message, some confidential information to Alice, you know, he encrypts it with a shared key, a key he shares with Alice. So K is a long bit string he shares with Alice. He encrypts it using that key, and Alice can decrypt it. She can recover the message, and an eavesdropper who's listening in which is not super hard thing to do if you're using a complex, system, vulnerable system like the internet, she can't learn anything because she just sees the ciphertext. So part of cryptography is having symmetric key encryption, where two parties share the same key, they scramble and unscramble with the same key. Of course, that means you need a way to establish keys. And not all parties have had the opportunity to meet in person in advance, exchange a symmetric key, and store it for future use years later. So typically what happens is we use something called a public key infrastructure to establish keys on the fly between two parties communicating through an authentic channel. It's not a secret channel, but it's an authentic channel, right? So when I'm shopping with Amazon, the fact that traffic, until we set up an encryption tunnel, it's vulnerable, but we have to believe that it's actually authentic. There isn't some person in the middle who's pretending to be Amazon to me or pretending to be me to Amazon. So of course, that's a third tool we need, which is called authentication. And typically what we do nowadays in most systems like the internet is we use public key authentication, which is part of a public key infrastructure. So the three tools that we use today, there's others. I think we're entering slowly a new era of modern cryptography where other tools, so-called secure multi-party computation, which allow sort of anonymous or confidential browsing of databases and so on, and other tasks are starting to emerge. But these three here are sort of the bread and butter of cryptography and information security as we practice it today. And I'll get back to these later on in the colloquium. Now, as I'm sure you're aware, and it was mentioned in the abstract, quantum computing threatens cryptography. And a typical initial reaction to that is, well, who cares? We already have a long list of threats and you're just adding to one. And in fact, the last time I checked, crypto hasn't really been a problem for me. So, it's not necessarily a rational argument, but it's just sort of a fuzzy argument that, people sometimes think, one to a very large N number of threats. But I think that's not quite the right way to analyze it. Because if you look at not every vulnerability is the same. So user errors, which are perhaps one of the largest sources of hacking and so on, and cause a lot of problems. So, or in some sense, to any one instance anyway, it's bad, let's say. But compared to a corrupt user who's deliberately trying to mess up the system, it's not as bad. Now there's more, non-corrupt users than corrupt users. So you might want to renormalize those two, but then in one instance, a corrupt user is worse than just a user who makes honest mistakes. Now, an admin error is worse than a user error. And it's hard to compare to a corrupt user because admin have more power, there's more at stake. Now, corrupt admin are very, they can cause a lot of damage. Doesn't happen as often as just somebody clicking on the wrong link. But, recently there was a bank in Quebec that was hit really hard by a corrupt admin, millions of users affected and they're, still reeling from that. And occasionally we'll see a platform implementation error like Heartbleed. So the design was essentially fine, but there was a buffer overflow there, which is a very common mistake. And these things happen. And these things are worse than, these are all debatable, these rankings, but they can be worse in that this affects an entire, MS Teams or if Zoom or if some, platform that many people use, that many applications are based on, like a cloud platform, that has a very, very broad impact. And fixing them, while often it's one day or a couple hours to fix the fundamental software error, doing quality assurance and deploying it through all the systems relying on it can often take up to a year. And these are sort of what I would consider the top of the iceberg. These are the things we experience all the time. We read about in the papers and billions and billions, if not, trillions of dollars of damage and human lives and so on have been lost because of these kinds of cyber attacks, you know, cyber attacks enabled by these sorts of things. You know, below the surface of, you know, the bottom part of the iceberg, there's platform design errors, which we don't really see much or hear much about. But if ever that happens, it's much harder to fix than just an implementation error. Now, crypto implementation errors, it's an apples and oranges comparison of the platform designs. Forms essentially use the same crypto. So crypto implementation error has a broader impact than just one platform having an error. But it's easier to fix an implementation error than to redesign something. But these are both very bad situations that we don't see very much, and we don't want to see. But I'd say at the bottom of this stack is fundamentally vulnerable crypto, because then it's super ubiquitous, because all our digital platforms are relying on the same small set for the most part. See, most of our digital platforms are mostly relying on the same crypto. So, and if it's not just an implementation error, which you just fix, the crypto doesn't work and we don't have a substitute available, then we have a serious problem, because adversaries, you can't rebuild. Like, the typical narrative in cybersecurity is you protect as much as you can, you detect intrusions and attacks as quickly as possible, and then you remediate as quickly as possible. And there's businesses designed to help with any and all three of those. But you have a problem with remediation if the crypto is broken, because that same crypto will be broken tomorrow as well. It's a digital key to the front door. So it's a serious business continuity problem. So I'm belaboring this. I just want to emphasize that fundamental crypto is not just another, you know, type of hack. It's a very dangerous, disruptive attack that is not easy to fix if we weren't proactive, if we weren't ready for the possibility that this crypto is broken. People will sometimes say, well, we could always, in theory, just do this. And I said, well, do you have that deployed? No. Do you have it designed? No. Like, how many years would it take you to deploy that alternative? And of course, it's you know, you have days, not years, in these cases. So you need to be ready for this possibility. And the bottom line is, we're not. We've just been lucky in that there hasn't been a serious break of our fundamental cryptography. And you know, just being safe against the known attacks, this is a real feel-good talk, by the way. Anyway, but just being secure against the known attacks is not enough, because there's ever new attacks being discovered all the time. So really, cybersecurity isn't about finding that perfect code or finding the perfect software tool or the right system. It's about having a strong cyber immune system, designing things in a principled way, being able to detect emerging vulnerabilities and quickly adapt to defend against them, which is very hard, and we're certainly not set up for that right now. So an example of an emerging threat is quantum computing. Now, those of us working in quantum computing don't think of it as a threat. We're not, and there's absolutely no reason for them to be a threat, but we have to actually take some non-trivial steps to make quantum computing, you know, just like any other high performance computer, as far as, you know, cryptanalysis is concerned. So really, where it's not a threat anymore, it's just another great tool for solving important problems. And you know, I'm not going to belabor the happy quantum side of the story. Many of us are working on all sorts of applications of quantum information technology, from computing, also sensing, developing new security tools. And I think for the most part, when we look back 20, 30 years from now, most of the applications of quantum technology will be things we hadn't thought of today, which is typically the case with any fundamentally new capability, such as wireless communication, or even something like the internet. At the beginning, we had no clue what it would be used for. And that's not because we're stupid, it's just the future is quite hard to predict. And there's all sorts of potential applications that we're digging deeply into now. And like I said, I think we're starting to scratch the surface and starting to get familiar with the useful applications of quantum computing. And I work a lot in these aspects as well. I'm just not going to get into this again, what Bill Munson calls happy quantum right now. But because of all the positive applications and the potential for great economic opportunity here, there's a so-called race to build a quantum computer. And scientists, both in academia and increasingly in industry, are trying to build a large-scale, fault-tolerant quantum computer, among other things. They're also trying to build sensors and so on. But one of the most ambitious, I mean, arguably the most ambitious quantum technology challenge is to build a scalable, fault-tolerant, large-scale quantum computer. And it's no longer just academics like us working at the university, in our labs and so on, but industry has invested billions in this space. And they have large teams of great researchers. I mean, we've taught, of course, as you many of you know, you've taught many of them. They're doing great work over there. Some of it's being published, some of it isn't. Some of it's not publishable, but it's definitely important. And it's left the, you know, in academia, as we know, you know, if we have to very quickly deploy a lot of resources to very specific tasks that are largely engineering, you know, academia is not the ideal place for doing that, especially not quickly. And that's fine. I think this is where industry typically takes over or start. I mean, it's a partnership. Academia is still playing a super vital role in advancing the field. An industry which has the ability to attract capital and put engineering teams on tasks and has a lot of the experience, sort of the non-research experience needed in the game in a very large way, in a very intense way in the recent, very recent years. And in China, especially in the last couple of years, where tens of billions of dollars have been allocated for quantum computing technology. Now, a litmus test for whether people are trying to, you know, we're really moving toward a useful quantum computer to solve problems is whether there's any software to be run on the computer, any applications, any software, any use cases. And up until recently, it was very high level for the most part. And there were algorithms, but there's still largely in algorithmic terms, they weren't really, you know, it was all big O notation, asymptotics, which is where we start. I mean, that's where the big disruptions are found. But when you're looking to actually apply them, you need a full software stack that takes those algorithms and compiles them down to solve real world problems. And you need smart people who look at the real world problems, who look at the known algorithms and see if they can apply them and see if there's maybe ways to optimize the algorithms or discover new algorithms. And that started to happen a lot in the last couple of years. I also volunteer at the Creative Destruction Lab in Toronto, and I coach a number of startups who are trying to apply quantum technology to solve important problems. It's still early days, but there's a lot of effort going there. And most, essentially all of the hardware vendors in the space are now talking about their software stack and their platform to engage potential users. You know, Airbus launches Quantum Computing Challenge, IBM announced it has 100 customers on its platform, and so on. I'll skip the next slide, but this is sort of what I think are the reasonable things that many people are doing now with quantum computers, even though a large-scale quantum computer is most likely many years into the future. I'll elaborate on what I mean by many. So several years into the future, it does make sense to start preparing for that day now and not wait till the last minute when there's sort of a phase transition and it becomes a bit of a rush. Now, while there's many positive applications of quantum computing, some are known, most yet to be discovered. You know, Peter Shor back in 1994 realized that we can actually break factoring-based public key cryptography. Now, back then, there's this alternative to factoring-based public key cryptography based called using discrete logarithms. And I think we always thought, well, even if somebody figures out how to factor large numbers, we can always rely on discrete logs as our failover. But Peter broke both of those in his famous paper. So we have a serious vulnerability in our public key infrastructure, in our cryptographic infrastructure, in our digital economy, basically. Now, in 94, it was not as bad as it is now. We're much more dependent, much more on these tools than we were back then. So things like RSA and ECC are, I mean, it's not literally zero. You know, you no longer have to do 2 to the 80 work to break RSA 2048. You need to do a few thousand, many thousands of quantum gates to break RSA 2048, but it's not 2 to the 80. So these it's poly in N instead of 2 to the N. So the public key cryptography like RSA and ECC is essentially completely shattered. The symmetric key cryptography like AES, which does the encryption, that is weakened. So it roughly, you know, is quadratically more powerful. So if you double the keys or hash lengths, that's more than enough to defend against the known quantum attacks. Are there other quantum attacks that are more powerful? Maybe, but we don't know of any. And the RSA and ECC type tools, those are what we do to establish keys and to authenticate who we're talking to on the internet today. So how soon will we have a quantum computer that can actually implement these attacks? Now, I don't know is the correct answer, but it's not a very useful answer. So how do we get some sort of idea for how big of a quantum computer do we need? So how soon will we have it? Well, it partly depends on how big of a quantum computer we need. And it also depends, of course, on when will we have a computer of that size. So how large of a quantum computer is needed? That's a continually moving number, right? It depends on the discovery of new algorithms or the improvement of algorithms and efficiently compiling them to fault-tolerant operations, to improvements of fault-tolerant schemes, right? To improving the hardware to be able to implement fault-tolerant schemes with less overhead, right? And there's, you know, smart people working at all these layers trying to build better devices with better connectivity or better features that enable lower overhead fault tolerance. You have, people like Daniel trying to discover new fault-tolerant schemes with less overhead. And a lot of my work is at the top two layers there, discovering new algorithms and finding ways to compile them to run on fewer and fewer physical quantum resources. So over the past few years, this is just a list of some of the tools, and there's several ongoing that we've applied to take a given algorithm like Shor's algorithm and compiling it down to the fewest number of fault-tolerant gates that people like Daniel tell us about and give us their relative costs. And we try to optimize the cost using mathematical tools. And I'll give a couple examples of the kinds of synthesis and optimization tools we came up with. The first one is a very simple one called meet in the middle. It's a very common method in computer science. So if you want to synthesize a unitary U called meet in the middle, it's a very common tool in computer science. Now, suppose you want to implement U. You want to synthesize it to use as few resources as possible. So U could be just one component of Shor's algorithm. You couldn't do this with all of Shor's algorithm. You would take a 10 qubit piece of it, synthesize the unitary corresponding to that piece, and then try to resynthesize it in a more efficient way, for example, to have the smallest cost. So say the depth, we want to minimize the depth of the circuit. Now let's suppose U has a depth 10 implementation. So one way to find a depth 10 implementation by brute force is simply try every possible gate. Let's say there's M possible gates at each time step, and you just pick them, you come up with a sequence of 10 of them. So there's M to the 10 possible such sequences. And you just try them all, and you pick one if it exists. Now that's, you notice if the depth is n, this grows exponential in n. It's c to the n, or so it's m to the n, say. Now what meet in the middle does says it's still exponential, but it says if you could be synthesized with a depth 10 circuit, you can split that depth 10 circuit into two depth 5 circuits, right? And you take the inverse of one, so you multiply it by U. So if U is equal to VW, then V inverse U equals W, where V and W each have depth 5. So a smarter way to try to synthesize U by brute force is to enumerate all depth 5 circuits right? And then multiply all depth five circuits by U and see if there's a match between those two. And if you get a match, you've now found a V and a W such that V inverse U is W, and therefore U is equal to VW. Right? So it's not, it's a simple idea. There's a lot of cleverness in trying to implement it and, you know, finding good data structures so you can use as little memory as possible and calculate it as quickly as possible. But it works. And with my student, Olivia Di Matteo, we found ways to parallelize this and to use much, much less memory to store all those tables. And one of the, you know, early successes with this brute force meet in the middle search was to synthesize a Toffoli gate. The Toffoli gate is a controlled knot. It's sort of the bread and butter of most reversible circuits, which are used in our quantum algorithms. And if you want to minimize time, you really want to minimize the depth of the circuit. And the previous, best known circuit for implementing the Toffoli gate had depth 5. Now I should back up a second. You know, the best known fault tolerance methods, or the most well studied or the most promising ones, there's a small handful of gates, and by far the most expensive one is the T gate. And more generally, these are the non-transversal gates. There's always one gate that is not going to be easy to implement. And that one, you have to use magic states or other related methods to implement that gate robustly. So these are 1 to 2 orders of magnitude more expensive than all the other gates. So to first order, we want to minimize how many of those gates we use. And if we're trying to reduce the time to implement the circuit, we want to have as few layers of those expensive gates. So assuming T gates are the most expensive gates, we want to minimize so-called T depth. And we brought it from 5 down to 3. So that's a substantial, 40% reduction in depth of circuits. Our friend Peter Selinger, who's at Dalhousie, figured out how to, with additional qubits, with additional workspace, he could bring that depth down to 1 in all cases. And we looked at his method and we generalized it. Here's an example where you have 2 qubits where you want to implement this very simple circuit, right? It's a controlled knot. So the first qubit 1, what we'll say is we're going to analyze it 1 string at a time. There's 4 possible input strings. Let's call them A, B. So qubit 1 stores A, qubit 2 stores B. You do a controlled knot, which computes A XOR, the A plus B mod 2 on the first qubit. Then it applies the T inverse gate, which puts an e to the minus I pi over 4 phase in front of 1 and leaves 0 alone. Then another C naught, which returns A plus B back to just A, and then 2 T gates. And you can map this down. You can do all your T gates at one shot, in one shot, if you add 1 ancilla bit. And the idea is really simple. If you look at that example, what we're really doing, that first T gate, if A and B is 1, A XOR B is 1, it puts in an e to the I pi over 4 phase. And those last 2 T gates, there's an A in the first bit and a B in the second bit, kick in a relative phase of e to the I pi over 4 if A is 1 and if B is 1. So mathematically, the expression is e to the I pi over 4 and the sum of 3 terms, negative A XOR B plus A plus B. And the idea is simply compute all those bit patterns. So start with A, B, that workspace bit 0 at the very bottom. Compute A XOR B in that third bit. Now you have all those bits you need in the exponent, and apply your T gate to each of those bits. They'll induce the phases you need, and then uncompute the ancilla bits and return the 2 bits you started with to what they were initially. So that's the general idea for how to, parallelize completely. But when you implement a circuit which only has C naught and T gates, that's not universal. It doesn't even create superposition. So the aim would be to optimize subcircuits using this method. In general, it takes the input bits A, B, C, and so on, does a sort of mapping, like below in the example, it went to, A XOR B, But it's a string of bits. It could be like A XOR B, comma B XOR C XOR D, and so on. That's what G at ABC represents. That's what a general purpose C naught and T circuit does. And the phases are just like in that example below, those F sub I, A, B, C, et cetera. Those are just XORs of the variables A, B, C, and D, various subsets of those variables. So when we thought about how to generalize this, so for example, let's just, we don't necessarily want to add one ancilla bit for every single term. So let's say we have a circuit whose corresponding polynomial has 80 terms in that exponent. Right, there's six variables. In other words, there's six input bits that could be zero or one. We're going to give you 2 bits of workspace. So there's 8 bits total of workspace. So you have 80 terms, only 8 bits, and you want to parallelize as much as you can. So you want to have as few levels as possible. So the most you could ever hope for is to do 8 terms at a time, because you only have 8 bits. And therefore, with 80 terms, you can maybe pack it into 10 rounds, 10 levels. Can you always do that? Well, it depends. There are constraints. You can't just put any 8 terms at the same time, because whatever the state of your quantum computer is at any one time step, you have to be able to recompute the input. So that's a constraint. So you're not allowed to do anything. There's a special constraint. And it turns out that optimization problem of partitioning into the fewest number of parts subject to these constraints is actually a matroid partitioning problem. So we applied matroid partitioning algorithms from the 1970s, actually designed by my colleague, you know, Jack Edmonds, who's in the CNO department. And we've implemented this algorithm that we developed. And I won't get into the details, but the bottom line is over 18 circuits that we tried, you know, common arithmetic circuits, we actually even reduced the number of T gates and the total depth, the so-called T depth. Even with no ancillas, we brought it down by, you know, 50% margin. And if we add, let's say it's a 5-qubit input, and let's say we give you 5 ancilla qubits in that case. In that case, we brought it down by an 80% factor, more than 80%. So these are non-trivial reductions that can, you know, significantly, not in an earth-shattering way, but it's a significant reduction that allows us to implement certain algorithms substantially sooner than if you don't have these optimizations. Now, that's just one example, a very nice example of how we applied, you know, one area of combinatorics to reduce the size of circuits. But there's several other tools. And when you combine them all together, we can get some serious reductions in the size of a circuit. Another example developed with my colleagues and my student, Vadim Klyushnikov, is about optimizing 1-qubit rotations. So in something like Shor's algorithm, you want to do a single qubit phase gate by, say, a pi over 16 factor, phase factor. That's, we don't know how to do that fault tolerantly. We have to recompile that simple phase gate into what we do know how to do fault tolerantly, such as the Clifford and T gates. I won't get into the details. I mean, there was no methods before. They all had some very unpleasant aspect. They either didn't give optimal circuits or ran in exponential time or polynomial time. The polytime algorithms didn't give optimal circuits. The only thing that gave optimal circuits are really the exponential time algorithms. And the ones that both had efficient algorithms and gave optimal circuits up to constant factors needed ancillas, large ancillas. So that was the problem we tackled. Now, Sarnak and others had proved the existence. We know there's, for an epsilon precise circuit, in other words, a circuit implements the desired unitary with precision epsilon, we know you can do it in depth log 1 over epsilon. There exist such circuits. But the only way to find them were these brute force methods, which are exponential time and quickly become infeasible. So our approach was to first analyze what was exactly synthesizable and with Clifford and T gates. And we could very easily recognize if a given unitary was exactly synthesizable, and we could super quickly synthesize it. So the remaining problem was, give me an arbitrary matrix over the complex, 1-qubit matrix over the complex numbers, and round it off to something in the exactly synthesizable set of unitaries. And this is, you know, sort of Diophantine approximation problem. I'm going to skip most of the details. So there's a round-off challenge, which was not so easy. And as we were studying it, my student Vadim noticed this neat thing where if you add, rounding things off is easy. Rounding things off and preserving unitarity, making the norm equal to exactly one, is not so easy. And Vadim noticed that if we give ourselves two n syllabits initialized to zero, and that we return to zero, and we try to implement that three-qubit unitary instead of a one-qubit unitary, the round-off problem, you round off, you know, and when you round it off, it's not necessarily likely going to have norm 2 to the n. So you have to add little error terms, a plus ib and c plus id, and hope that that, and make that new vector have weight. Again, the integer parts weight 2 to the n, so that when you normalize by 1 over 2 to the n, you have 1. So the bottom line is you need to find integers a, b, c, and d such that their squares add up to some known integer m. And that's the Lagrange 4-square problem, which my colleague Jeff Shalit in our CS department at Waterloo and Michael Rabin, the famous Israeli cryptographer, solved efficiently in the 1980s. So that was a nice little result. It's been improved upon and so on, using matrix norm equations and so on. But it was certainly a fun step in this overall process. Now, we've been taking all these methods we've been developing and our colleagues have been developing around the world and assessing what does it mean for the known cryptanalytic attacks. And we've done sort of the full vertical integration from the algorithms, the compilation, fault tolerance for specific error rates, how many surface code cycles will it take to break AES 192, right? We calculated it and it's about 2 to the 121 when we did this work 4 years ago. abstractly, you know, we say, well, you can brute force search AES 192 in 2 to the 192/2 steps, right? So 2 to the 96 steps. That doesn't factor in all the costs of synthesizing the circuits, doing the fault tolerance and so on. So that increases it up to 2 to the 121 surface code cycles, for example. So we want to track these. It means, you know, one shouldn't panic about AES 192. In fact, NIST is telling people not to panic about AES 128 either. It's not a bad idea to go to bigger keys, but it's not a do or die thing in the short term. And we've done similar analyses for the hash function, hash functions SHA-2 and SHA-3. Coming back to RSA 2048, which is one of the most widely used algorithms out there, with Vlad, we've been for the last 2 years, every 6 months, you know, reassessing the costs, and we published a cumulative, you know, our 2 years worth of work early in 2019 and shaved off a couple orders of magnitude over what was in the previous literature. And Gidney at Google and Martin Ecker in Sweden, they went after the algorithms at the top and also some of the a lot of the implementations of the circuits and functions, and we're able to shave off another 2 orders of magnitude. So we're talking about 4 orders of magnitude reduction in the total cost, both memory and depth, of breaking RSA. And we're not stopping. We're continuing to work on it and continuing to reduce the cost. I think there's still a lot of improvements to be done. And that's one input into when will we break RSA 2048 with a quantum computer. I just want to right now just point out that what does it mean again to break RSA 2048 or, you know, ECC or all these public key algorithms or key agreement signatures? Well, they underpin all the security, either those and or the symmetric algorithms like SHA and AES underpin all of our, security of all of our digital infrastructures. And quantum computers decimate, as I mentioned earlier, RSA and ECC and any discrete log system and weaken symmetric key crypto. So it's bad if we're not ready. And I'm just going to note that, to clarify that, because when people in industry hear the never-ending and increasing flow of headlines they're not easy to parse and to understand what the impact is for cybersecurity. And when people, the only way we know how to break RSA or ECC or any of these codes is with a fault-tolerant, large-scale quantum computer. Things like quantum annealers or quantum simulators or noisy intermediate-scale quantum are not a known threat to crypto. Might they be? Well, maybe, and we're going to keep tracking it, but to date, they aren't. They might be useful, but they're not a known threat to crypto, which takes me to just some of the work I've been doing in the last few years. There have been some articles, you know, as a, for whatever reason, people have chosen to benchmark certain SAT solving, certain SAT problems on quantum annealers or quantum SAT solvers of various kinds. And the SAT instances they chose were derived from factoring problems. And I think even in classical computing, getting SAT instances from factoring problems, they do it not because they're trying to factor, but because factoring is a good way to get hard random instances of SAT. With many NP complete problems, with most, it's hard to get a hard random instance. And one heuristic for doing that is to take a factoring problem, reduce it to your favorite NP problem, and that tends to be hard on average. So it's a method for testing your SAT solvers. It's not a method for factoring classically. And we studied this and came to the same conclusion, not a surprising conclusion, that we don't see that quantum SAT solvers are a good way to factor large numbers. Because there are good factoring algorithms that are much better than exponential brute force. So whereas SAT solvers tend to be exponential. So we don't think a bit of quantum enhancement to a SAT instance, to SAT solving, will be useful for factoring. Of course, we might be wrong. We just don't see that. Now, another apparently unrelated work, but it isn't, was an earlier work I did where, like, one thing I want to know is, do we need 4,000 logical bits to break RSA? Like, what if I only had 300 qubits? Then what? Is it completely useless or could we do something? Well, one thing we could do is we could go into the guts of the number field sieve, which is used to factor numbers today, and speed it up with a quantum computer. And we get, it's still a sub-exponential algorithm, but it was with lower constants. So it could potentially impact factoring. And a very recent result, we said, for people who do want to try to apply SAT solvers to factoring, they should follow the approach we took with Bernstein and Bias and try to speed up smoothness testing, because there, just a non-trivial speed up in SAT solving would actually give you a better factoring. And I don't think this is a super hopeful path for factoring, but it's a sensible one might try. But back to, you know, cybersecurity. So we know quantum computers will break two of the, you know, both signatures and key agreement. How soon do we need to worry? Well, that depends. So on the one hand, we can't wait till we have quantum computers because there won't be time to react. And a formula that summarizes how much time we have, so we're doing this in a disciplined, non-panicked way, is let X be the number of years your information is supposed to be secure. Let Y be the time it takes you to migrate to new quantum algorithms, new quantum resistant algorithms, and Z is the collapse time. So for the next Y years, you're stuck with the quantum vulnerable codes because you haven't had time to migrate to new ones. You're supposed to provide an additional X years of confidentiality, except if X plus Y is bigger than Z, you're not. So you're already too late in that case. So it's sort of been a guiding light for quantum risk management for a number of years now. How close are we to Z? Well, you know, the so-called quantum supremacy achievement by Google is an important, very important experimental milestone. Now, the term quantum supremacy is criticized for various reasons, but the experimental achievement is, while it doesn't open the floodgates, you can't break any codes with it, it is an important experimental milestone. The most critical milestone is when we achieve a fault-tolerant qubit, one that we can scale in a system where we can scale it with sort of reasonable effort, where, you know, one qubit might be encoded in hundreds, if not thousands, of physical layer qubits. So in terms of estimating this Z parameter, our friends in Germany have been doing a nice study which outlines all the challenges, all the steps we need to achieve, and we're currently somewhere between their C and D. It's a nice report. There's a version in English, and they update it regularly. We did a similar report through the NAS in the US, except it's not being updated regularly. My own estimates have gone from a 0% chance that we'll break RSA in 20 years to over 80% chance. I think there's probably a 20% chance in 10 years. I have a methodology. It's not just a random guess. I break it up into a number of steps and have a methodology for coming up with these estimates. And we also conducted a survey of these 22, you know, well-recognized thought leaders who are experimentalists. They design quantum computers. They work on fault tolerance. They work on algorithms with a deep understanding of the devices side of things. And we wrote a histogram. We produced a histogram of their answers. This is a useful reference for those who are trying to gauge when are we going to have a quantum computer that can factor large numbers. We still don't know, but I think risk managers need to know, you know, by unlikely, do you mean, you know, 10% or 0.01%? Because that's a very different, you know, one might be a tolerable risk and the other isn't. Now, we do know what to do about it. So it's not like all hope is lost and, you know, we can't do, the internet is no longer secure and, you know, we can't have any cryptography anymore. It's not at all true. There's a, more or less, in quotes, a plug-in replacement for public key crypto, which is a new generation of public key crypto designed to resist quantum attacks. It doesn't need any quantum infrastructure. It's just designed to be resilient to quantum attacks. And this is sort of a, you know, the so-called plug-in replacement, but it's a lot harder than it sounds. And then quantum cryptography, which uses some quantum technology, but not a large-scale quantum computer in most cases, and achieves cryptographic primitives that typically don't have a computational assumption. So it's a much, these are much better tools from a security perspective. They might be less available, less efficient, and more expensive, but they're more secure, especially if done right and combined in an appropriate way with conventional cryptography. So these two tools make our tool chest stronger than it ever was, stronger than we ever thought it was possible even. And the, what we mean by the term quantum safe, which we coined a number of years ago, was it's designed to be safe in the air with large scale quantum computers. So it includes conventional algorithms that don't need quantum communication as well as quantum cryptography. Now QKD is in a sense the ultimate key establishment tool because you don't have to worry about future cryptanalysis. As long as it was securely implemented, and even if there were endpoint vulnerabilities at the time, as long as they weren't exploited at the time, you can't exploit them in the future. And while it's sort of a point-to-point niche business right now, with trusted repeaters, there'll be networks with some trust assumptions at the repeaters, and eventually with quantum memories and quantum repeaters, we won't have to trust the QKD service provider anymore. We just have to trust the endpoints. And I think when I'm talking to people about the real world application of QKD, you know, I encourage them not to obsess with where the puck is now, but where it's going. So it takes years, decades to architect our security infrastructure. So if we want a capability in 20 years, we can't start thinking about it in 18 years. It's something we have to start planning in now. So we know the physicists are going to build a quantum internet, right? Whether the security people want it or not. And I think our job, sort of my security hat on, is to take advantage of this wonderful new tool that is emerging. And I think it's a very fluky, you know, historical time in that we're rebuilding cryptography. We're opening the crypto tool chest because we have to, because of quantum attacks. We're going to deploy new, you know, mathematical algorithms. Now is the time to figure out quantum cryptography's role in that tool chest, in particular QKD, as well as quantum random numbers. I'll skip that part. And, you know, whatever we do, we always advocate doing in a hybrid mode. So if you're going to introduce QKD, don't stop using your existing protocols. Use both and combine the keys in a way that you have to break both codes. It's a great way to mitigate risk, especially for those who are averse to using a new tool that hasn't been probably vetted in the field yet. You know, deploying new tools is a lot harder than proving it's secure. On my whiteboard, you have to go through very long and complicated processes for standardizing them and ultimately validating them. And NIST in the United States has been working on that for over for about 4 years now. We've been coordinating an annual workshop, bringing together stakeholders from academia, industry, government, policymakers, standards makers, to discuss, where we are and where we need to be in terms of globally deployed, standardized new crypto. The last one was at Amazon headquarters in November. The next one's aimed at, we're implementing it in Etsy headquarters in France. For now, again, on the one hand, we don't need to panic because the quantum threat isn't here, but it does take a lot to plan and execute properly. We don't get to call a timeout if we didn't plan, just like we don't get to call a timeout with the coronavirus and make masks and whatever. We're not going to get to call a timeout when this threat, as well as other cyber threats, are really near. So to help with the process, we've developed an open source platform that people can use today to test how post-quantum cryptography can work on their systems and to see if their systems will crash or not, or to even use to protect their systems against using these new quantum safe codes. If they want to start, be able to hit the ground running when NIST produces standards in 2022 or 23. This is a widely used tool now. This is sort of the internal, people put in implementations of the new algorithms, and at the top, all sorts of applications that take advantage of them, and we can benchmark them and very easily try one algorithm versus another. We also have to look not just at existing platforms, but future platforms like blockchains. And to help advance QKD, I think we don't wait until QKD networks are globally deployed and it's virtually impossible to get people to change their software to use it. I think now is the time to start figuring out how QKD can work in your networks. And so we've, on top of the physical layer of QKD, there's two software layers as well as the application layer. So we've been implementing those in open source and making them available for people so they can do proofs of concept, or use them as a reference implementation for their own implementations. So just to wrap up, I think we are it's a very unusual fluke, because typically in security, we don't fix things until they're broken. But when they're broken, you're not really in a good position to fix them. So we have this, maybe quantum computing was a blessing in disguise, in that it's a very, decimating threat, but not today. Like, usually you find out about the threat when it's hitting you, not 20, 30 years in advance. But by this historical fluke, we've known since 1994 that these codes will be broken someday. We don't know when, but if and when, and now I think it's more of a when than an if, a quantum computer exists, these codes will have to be replaced. And if we take a disciplined, proactive approach, because if we rush, we're going to build something that is very flawed and even susceptible to classical attacks. Whereas if we take a disciplined security by design approach, we'll actually be able to rebuild it stronger than it ever was. So it's in that sense, this is my happy part of the ending, that this might have been a blessing in disguise, like a warning that is getting us to, have more disciplined, agile, and security by design approach to our digital infrastructures. So thanks a lot for your attention. If it's possible, I'm happy to take questions.
Thank you, Mika. So let's start, see if there's any questions from students. We have one from Leo Fang.
Leo, is it on the chat or?
Oh, sorry, that's a clapping, not a hat. Never mind.
Okay, thank you.
Sarah Lee.
Hi, Sarah.
Hi, Dr. Muska, thank you so much for your talk. I do have a question about this the QKD you just mentioned. And we all know that in classical computer, we have TCP/IP as a network protocol, which is agreed by like this general community. Although we don't really have this physical device set up, do you think it's feasible for us to start thinking about this quantum protocols, or you think you'd have to wait until we really have the physical thing set up?
Yeah, that's, so I think what you're asking is, you know, beyond just a QKD network, which is one task for so-called quantum internet, if you want to build, you know, a real full-fledged quantum internet, we have to sort of redefine what packets are and have new data types where you flag which bits are quantum and which are classical, or where the routers or maybe superpositions of sending your packets to one address or another, or who knows what. I think people are starting to think about that. My gut feeling is it's certainly premature to bake it in, but it's maybe not premature to start thinking about, because we're still many years away from having those issues to deal with. Like for QKD networks, we don't need that. We don't need those standards, I don't think. We need standards for the specific purposes of QKD, and those are being developed. But for like a full-fledged quantum internet, like we don't have robust quantum memories yet. We don't have quantum repeaters yet. And I think these are things people will be working on for many years to come in terms of how to define the quantum equivalent of a packet. Mm-hmm. I think we still need to wait. Like when we're thinking of quantum compilers 20 years ago, you know, I think there was some good work done, but it was still a bit early. We didn't have enough of maturity to understand what we'd really need. Now we know, I think, 80% of what we'll need, at least. So it makes sense to be working on compilers for quantum computers. And I think slightly early, but not too early to start thinking of the foundations. But definitely, I think, so the foundational research makes sense, I think. Mm-hmm. But we're still many, many years away from ever wanting to start standardizing them. But it's certainly time to start exploring. So that, like, what'll happen is at some point, we actually can start building quantum networks. And then that's not a good time to start figuring out, but wait a minute, you know, how should these things interoperate? Then you want the principles to have been figured out before you have the hardware.
Thanks.
Okay, any other student questions?
I have one question. Can you talk about a good key distribution in quantum networks? And are there any research work already done on these areas? And can you suggest some materials?
I didn't catch the key phrase. Which area?
Oh, good key distribution.
Oh, yeah. It, like with quantum or post-quantum?
Post-quantum, either, can you both talk about?
Yeah. Yeah, so just to explain what she means. So sometimes, like I define the three most primitive and ubiquitous, you know, cryptographic primitives we definitely need to replace, you know, fix ASAP. But we also have to worry that the new age crypto, as I sometimes call it, is also quantum resilient. It doesn't make sense to deploy a new cryptographic tool over the next 10 years if it'll be broken by a quantum attack and we have no clue how to fix it. Like, you need to either have a strategy for shutting it down or have some sort of transition plan. So one of the tools that people, it's being used today as well, is where it's not just one Alice and one Bob pairwise key agreement, but you might have 20 people who want to somehow establish a common key so they can all access the same file. And of course there's ways to do it, you know, by using pairwise key agreement, but it's not so elegant, not so efficient. But classically there's methods using pairings and so on to have 20 people have a, you know, group conversation. They each derive the same key, but the adversary who's listening to everything they were saying doesn't know the key. And there is some work being done on post-quantum alternatives. One of my colleagues did it with isogenies. I think he mentioned, I think I was on his PhD committee, so I'm trying to remember it, but they're not pretty so right now. So I think there's still a lot of interesting work to be done on post-quantum. And I would guess, I'm not familiar with the latest on quantum multi-user key agreement. Obviously we have the no cloning theorem to contend with and so on, but it's probably an interesting open problem as well. But I don't know the state of the art in quantum sort of, I imagine there's been a small number of papers attempting it or looking at it. But I don't think it's a solved problem either way, like either impossibility proofs or protocols or hybrid, you know, can you do it? Like, here's an interesting question. Can you have a one way? So classically to do key agreement, you need a trapdoor predicate. So what if quantumly I'll give you a one-way function, which is not enough to do key agreement classically? Can I give you that plus quantum and then do, you know, something such as group key agreement? So great question. I hope I answered it.
Okay. Thanks.
Any more questions from students? Okay, maybe throw it open to questions from everybody now. Okay, well, in that case, I guess on behalf of everybody, thanks, Michele, for that talk. And thank you everyone for coming. I'm afraid there are no refreshments in the bistro this time, but I certainly encourage you to go provide your own refreshments, right, as Michele is doing. Okay, thanks.
Thanks everyone, take care.